This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. It's the 1st of October 2009 here in Japan, and today I am honored to be joined on the line by G. Edward Griffin, the lecturer, researcher, and writer who has been toiling for decades in the pursuit of liberty and freedom. Mr. Griffin, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join me today.
Well, thank you, James. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, Mr. Griffin, the foresight that guided people like yourself and Bob Chapman and Gary Allen and others decades ago when liberty was not so obviously in peril has by now been proven by has proven your detractors over the years quite wrong. And now you'd have to look pretty hard to find someone who wasn't aware that our basic liberties and freedoms are in jeopardy. And of course, unfortunately, with that increased awareness that there is a problem, doesn't necessarily come an increased understanding of the problem. So as someone who's been researching and pondering these threats for many years, what can you tell us about the nature of the threat we're facing today?
Well, I think that's a very profound question, James. I like the question because many people are too obsessed, I think, with looking at the surface manifestations of our problems. On our website, we have a little paragraph that people seem to respond to. We say, we should not be like cats. And then we go on and explain that if you toss a pebble at a cat, the cat will look at the pebble. But if you toss a pebble at a dog, the dog will look at you. And that's what we sort of find in the world of news events and world-changing events. Too many people are looking at the pebble. They're looking at the effect. They're looking at the demonstrations, the riots, the loss of purchasing power, the growth of the police state. All of these things that annoy them, corruption in government. But they don't really focus on who's causing that to happen or what is causing that to happen. And that's the essence of your question, so I really like it. In my view, the underlying engine for almost all of the problems that concern us today is an ideology of all things. It's not even people. Yes, there are people with names, and they hold positions and all of that, but they're always changing. Those people are replaced by other people. And if you look at the common thread between them, it's that they share a common ideology. They all think the same. And so it really makes no difference who is in power or who holds that particular position. Nothing really changes. We've noticed as we go from one decade to the next, from one political party to the next, from one regime to the next, people die, new ones come up. Nothing changes. The trend just continues. And it's because all of those people in the chain of command have shared an ideology. Well, what is the ideology? It's called collectivism. It's a strange word to the ear for many people today, but as I was doing my research a little while ago, I discovered that the word collectivism was quite commonly used and well understood about a century ago. You'll find it a lot in the political writings of our forefathers and the historians of the time. And when you start analyzing it, we realize that today's world and yesterday's world hasn't really changed that much except words. The underlying struggle is between two ideologies, two political views. One is collectivism and the other one is individualism. And there again is a word that hasn't been very well used of late, but it's very common in the older literature. But these words I'm attempting to revive and cause people to understand the differences between collectivism and individualism. And although we don't have the time for this brief session to go into it all, I'll just give you an overview. Collectivism is the concept of great big government, of control from the top down, all power at the top, and the people at the bottom being but mere little serfs and servants of the larger group, the society, the state, the government. Individualism is the other way around, just tip the pyramid upside down, that the foundation of the whole society is the individual, and the purpose of society is to protect the rights of the individual. and to guard the individual even against the group if necessary. And so they're two entirely different philosophies. The underlying philosophy of collectivism is that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual must be sacrificed if necessary for the greater good of the greater number. That's what I was taught when I went to school. This greater good for the greater number sounded so good to me. And a lot of people have bought into it. And so once you buy into that, then you're defenseless, because any atrocity that you can possibly imagine, any infringement of your personal liberties, any affront against your physical body could be justified in the name of, well, it's just necessary for the greater good of the greater number. It's necessary for the state. It's necessary for society. And this is how the despots of our era always justify sacrificing huge numbers of people by claiming that they are the minority and that they must be sacrificed for some greater good. And we find that underlying philosophy behind communism, behind fascism, Nazism, socialism, anyism. You just take the labels off, get rid of those stupid little names on the tops, and look down beneath the label, and you find at the core of all of these isms is this thing called collectivism. Well, our nation has moved into collectivism. It started to move about the time of the Wilson administration, and it was really in full movement by the time of the First World War. And every time we have another war or another crisis, the acceleration continues. Now that we have a war on crime, a war against drugs, a war against pornography, you know, everything is a war, and it's a crisis, and people are scared, and they're turning to their government to say, oh, please, government, take control of everything. Gladly, we give up our liberties if you can protect us. And so this idea of protecting the larger number has just invaded our society, and we no longer have restrictions on government leaders. They can do anything they jolly well please. Constitution is nothing anymore to restrict their actions, as long as they can claim, well, this is necessary in this war against terror. It's good. We need it for national security. In other words, the greater good of the greater number. Everything that is done today to take away our liberties is done in the name of the greater good of the greater number. So this is the underlying philosophy. It's an ideology, and as long as people let that continue unchallenged, then there is no hope of turning around. There is no hope of reestablishing personal freedom again. We're just going to see this thing continue to decline to the point where we end up in a totalitarian system, not too different from the regimes of the past, the Middle Ages, serfdom. The only thing is, this will be a high-tech serfdom. We'll have television, you know, we'll have refrigerators, but people will still be highly regimented, and they will work for their masters and be told what to do. So that's my analysis of what's happening in the world today, and I think it's very important that people start to understand the ideological foundation of this movement, and then to stand up and recapture control of the system and reverse that trend and restore liberty once again.
I couldn't agree more, but returning to the idea of labels once again, many people have chosen to identify the system or even the group of people that were opposed by it as the New World Order, and certainly that is a phrase that seems to be particularly in vogue with globalists and collectivists of all stripes these days. What stock do you put in such a phrase, and how would you define the New World Order?
Well, I don't put much stock in the phrase because it doesn't really mean anything. It's like a code word. It means different things to different people. The elitists who use it have a very special meaning. They mean that it is a global system of collectivism based on the model of collectivism with their own particular elite group in control at the top. And that's what they mean by it. However, when they deliver that phrase and it's repeated over the media, or, you know, they give it in speeches and there are large audiences listening to it, it has a more soothing definition. People think of it as being nice and good. And George Bush the First, I think, when he introduced that phrase at the United Nations some years ago, he always followed it up with the phrase that we will live under a new world order, a world of law. And it's, those are soothing words, a world of law. Well, you see, people don't stop and think that the people in Nazi Germany lived under the rule of law. It's not a question of rule of law. It's a question of what kind of law. What are the limits on the law? And, you know, what's the philosophy behind the law? But nobody thinks about those things. They just respond emotionally to these phrases. The new world order sounds much better than the old world anarchy. But, you know, so you ask me what stock I put in the words. I don't put any stock in the words because I know that generally they're being used as propaganda phrases to soothe the population into some kind of apathy or approval of the process without them realizing that this new world order and so-called rule of law is actually a growing tyranny. And so that's the stock I put in it, which is zero.
Well, given that this New World Order, or whatever we call it, is the exact antithesis of all the ideals that we cherish, how can we effectively oppose it?
Well, we can. I think the active word there is effectively. We can oppose it, of course, in every way that we can, primarily through argument, through debate, through reasoning, through study of history. In other words, we can advocate that there is a better way. We can advocate that the concept of individualism is a far superior social order than collectivism. But that's not an effective opposition to it, because what happens is that individualists like us tend to gravitate away from power centers. We don't like to control other people's lives, and so very few of us want to go into politics. We don't want to go into government work. We just don't like that. We want to be individuals. We want to produce. We want to pursue the American dream or whatever, let other people alone to do what they want to do and hope they leave us alone. But collectivists are not that kind at all. These are the controllers. These are the social engineers. These are the people that want to tell you and me what to do with our lives for our own good, of course, for the greater good of the greater number. And they gravitate into positions of leveraged power over people. So they go into government, and they're the ones that wind up in political position. They're the ones that wind up controlling the police forces and the military units, and they actually dictate to us what we must do. And if we oppose them, they throw us in prison or deny us of existence, as they say in China, one of the great collectivist societies of the world. So to effectively oppose collectivism, I believe we have to go to the power centers where this power is concentrated and remove the collectivists from their positions of authority. In other words, we've got to get into politics. We've got to go into all of the media centers. We've got to go into the school systems. We've got to go into the church organizations, the labor unions, all of these positions of social, the power centers is what the sociologists call it. We have to become active in those groups and do our best to become influential and to provide leadership. Only then can we dislodge the collectivists from those pinnacles of power, and only then can we effectively oppose it.
I absolutely agree with that analysis. So tell people about Freedom Force International.
Well, Freedom Force International is an organization that I created in 2002, which was aimed specifically at accomplishing that goal, which is to help each other, to create a network, a support network, so that we can help each other go into the power centers of society where we should have been all along. It's not like infiltrating them. We should have been in these civic organizations and social organizations because it's an obligation we have, I think, to make our voices on behalf of freedom heard and to put ourselves in a position where we can offer leadership. Because most people, are content to follow. They really don't have much of an appetite for these deeper issues. They'll pretty much follow whoever is in charge. So we know that the great battle for control of a nation or a society really is fought among about 3% of the population or less. It's that 1 to 3% that struggle for dominance, and the rest will follow. So we recognize that. We may not like that reality, but we'd like to think that we're in that 3%, and we have an obligation to create a better system and to provide better leadership so that the masses will follow us on behalf of freedom instead of following into their own enslavement.
Well, tell people about the websites and where they can go to find out more information about your work.
Yes, well, all of the information and the theology, not the theology, it's not theology at all, actually, it's ideology. All of the thinking and the ideology and the history of what I've been talking about here is found on the Freedom Force website, and that's freedomforceinternational.org, freedomforceinternational.org. Lots of material there, and be prepared to spend many, many hours. You'll find so much stimulating information there, and we hope, of course, that many people will want to join our ranks. We now have members in, I think it's 67 or 68 countries now, which is very gratifying, because as we predicted in the beginning in 2002, we knew that this problem, this fight against collectivism, was international, everywhere in the world. It's not just in America. And in many ways, people who have lived under the worst totalitarian systems of all, people who have come from Germany or former Soviet Russia or even China, they're the ones who get this message much faster than a lot of Americans who have not yet seen it. And so we have people all over the world, and you'll find everything about Freedom Force at freedomforceinternational.org. But our commercial site, where we have about 100 different books and video and audio recordings, which provide the historical and analytical information to back up this ideology, you'll find all of that at another site called Reality Zone. Real easy to remember, realityzone.com. And I think you'll enjoy that site especially.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Griffin, it has been an honor having you on the program today. And I would just like to thank you once again for all of the incredible work that you've done bringing this information to the public's attention for so many years.
Well, thank you, James. It sounds like you've been studying this carefully yourself. I like your comments and your questions. So I doubly thank you for that.